hoping for a surprise today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's giving a big speech in Saudi Arabia this weekend. And despite his past rhetoric, this Muslim American hopes Trump will surprise her.
I'm hoping that he will take the opportunity to unify people and condemn the anti-Muslim incidents that have been happening, particularly here in the United States.
The president's also heading to Israel, the country that reportedly provided the secrets Trump then shared with Russia. Apparently, some Israelis find that funny.
From your perspective, I understand that this leak is very important, but here it's just a, you know, just another funny Trump joke.
Plus, a biologist who listens to the trees.
So here we're hearing the big raindrops falling from high in the canopy.
It's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Happy Friday to you. Glad you could be here. Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the Vatican. Right there is a big chunk of the 8-day itinerary for President Trump's first trip overseas. Sounds like a pilgrimage through Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, and that's not accidental. The White House says Trump intends to play up the unity among peoples of different faiths. Officials say his message will be one of tolerance and moderation. It's risky for any global leader to be stepping into religion, but Trump, of course, brings his own unique baggage. The World's religion reporter Matthew Bell starts us off today.
Donald Trump is going to Saudi Arabia to sell some American weaponry, to meet with business execs, and to give a speech to a room full of Muslim leaders about Islam.
To be honest, it conjured a roll of the eyes. Like, oh, really? Come on.
That was the initial reaction for Rula Alooch. She's with the Council on American Islamic Relations. As she thought a little more about it, though.
You know, one thing that we can say about the president is that he's been unpredictable. And so I'm hoping that as we lead up to the speech, that he will take the opportunity to use it as a time to unify people, as a time to condemn the anti-Muslim incidents that have been happening, particularly here in the United States. Since the presidential campaign and since his administration took office, and to clarify his thought on Islam as one of the world's great religions.
If Trump decides to do that in his Saudi speech, it would amount to a 180-degree pivot away from many of his statements about Muslims on the campaign trail.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Do you think Islam is at war with the West?
I think Islam hates us. There's something there that there's a tremendous hatred there. There's a tremendous hatred. We have to get to the bottom of it. There is an unbelievable hatred of us.
In Islam itself?
You're going to have to figure that out, okay?
The focus of Trump's first foreign trip as president makes sense, says Aaron David Miller. Miller is with the Wilson Center in D.C., and he advised several U.S. presidents from both parties on the Middle East peace process.
In Trump land, all roads begin, at least, with an effort to differentiate yourself from your predecessor. I'm sure that whoever devised the notion of this world religion tour took a look at the fact that Mr. Obama in June of 2009 went to Saudi and then on to Cairo to give this groundbreaking, transformative speech on reaching out to the Muslim world.
And a greeting of peace from Muslim communities in my country. Assalamu alaikum.
Aaron David Miller says the thinking in the Trump White House is to do something bigger and better than Obama by touching base with three world religions. The symbolism, Miller says, is about bridge building.
The problem, of course, it's hard to look at religion when it comes to conflict resolution as a device that doesn't get you into trouble. And Jerusalem, of course, is that, you know, the mother of all problems when it comes to sorting this out.
Trump plans to go to the Western Wall in Jerusalem's Old City. This is an extremely sensitive place for Jews and Muslims, and Trump would be the first sitting U.S. president to visit there. Miller says that Trump should just try to get through this trip by offending the fewest people possible. The easiest part of the tour for the president is probably the Vatican, where Trump will meet Pope Francis. But it's an open secret that these are two men with very different personalities, says Thomas Reese. He's a Jesuit priest and an analyst for the National Catholic Reporter.
Pope Francis is a humble man who wants to live a poor lifestyle, identifies with the poor, reaches out to the poor. President Trump has got this huge ego, and his policies, are not really all that much concerned about the poor. He's pushing tax cuts for the rich.
Reese says Trump and Francis also disagree on the treatment of immigrants and refugees, the border wall, and the effects of climate change. Still, the Pope has indicated that he will not use a public meeting to embarrass Trump. That's not how the Vatican conducts public diplomacy. Any substance to come out of this portion of the trip would happen behind closed doors. Then President Trump will end his religion-infused tour and return to the unforgiving reality of Washington politics. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Trump's got family with him on this overseas trip. Daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner are along for the ride. One catch, though, today is Friday, the Jewish Sabbath, and Kushner and Ivanka Trump are Orthodox Jews. That means no travel on the Sabbath. You can't even touch the automated kiosk for a boarding pass. But they managed to get special dispensation from an unnamed Israeli rabbi, and some Jews are not happy about it. There's a word for this online. It's called Shomer shaming. The Yiddish word for observing the Sabbath is Shomer Shabbos. Simon Yisrael Fierman has written for the Jewish publications, the Tablet magazine and the Forward. First of all, tell me more about the restrictions on travel on the Sabbath.
So the laws are very complex, but they are understood universally as if travel is forbidden on the Sabbath, period. Travel doesn't mean walking down the street. It means leaving one's town. It certainly means going on a plane or anything that would require breaking any of the innumerable laws regarding ignition and fire.
So on what basis can Jews get dispensation for breaking any of these rules?
Someone's life would have to be in danger in order to get a dispensation.
Doesn't really seem like anybody's life is in danger here. This is an official presidential trip.
You know, there's a Yiddish word called opklang, which roughly means a vibe or a reverberation. And, you know, when it comes to the fine points of the law, almost anything can be argued. And one could, in fact, argue that there are world affairs at stake, there are countries that potentially could be on the brink of war, and that potentially there would be lives at stake in theory. The problem here is that the reverberation coming from Kushner and from Trump about rules in general makes this rather opaque. We have a dispensation, but we're not going to tell you who. We have tax returns, but we don't release them. There's a sense that we're not accountable to you because we can do whatever we please.
So this rabbi is anonymous who provided the dispensation. Yeah. Do we know anything about him?
None. Zero. In a sense, it makes it worse by saying there's an anonymous rabbi. I mean, it would be better to say I didn't ask. But an anonymous rabbi, it's like citing an anonymous climate expert saying that it's all bunk.
Why is it anybody's business, though, how the Kushners choose to practice their religion?
In a social sense, it is not anyone's business. But if you are a member of a faith group, then you are not to be controlled by the group, but you are accountable to the group.
So would you call the reaction to this episode Shomer shaming?
The idea that there's Shomer shaming has a resonance. Because in a community where people are observing rules, and we know that not everyone observes the rules all the time, there ought to be a lot of latitude for people to, quote-unquote, be themselves. But this is not talking about them as individual people who, quote-unquote, have a right to do whatever they want. Jared Kushner is not my buddy. He's not my friend. They are political figures on the world stage. There is an opportunity here to bring honor to the Jewish people by being careful about the rules of the Sabbath. And there's also an opportunity to shame the Sabbath. The Sabbath, which is a derivative of our understanding of God, is being shamed on the world stage by casual behavior. Casual behavior. If there was a ruling and it was done with gravity and it was known who made the ruling and on what basis, that would honor the Sabbath. All I know is that to cite an anonymous source and to play a footsie with the Sabbath is not something that's right.
Simon Yisrael Fierman has written for The Forward and Tablet magazine. Donald Trump arrives in Israel on Monday, and there's one person there who can't wait. Uri Fink is an Israeli comic artist. Think of him kind of like the Gary Trudeau of Israel. His long-running weekly comic series, Bang, has been going strong since 1987. Uri joins us now from Greater Tel Aviv, or as you call it, Uri.
Biglier Tel Aviv. It's Biglier.
Biglier Tel Aviv. Well, it is a big city. Yeah. And depend yeah, on who you ask, it's the capital. As a cartoonist, what do you see when you observe Donald Trump?
I think his size. I mean, the general size, like this brute. You know, it's like these gigantic brute colors and everything's so colorful. The thing is that you do the coloring. You always have to do a different color in the eyes. Everything's orange in the face, and then you got these eyes, which is different color because it's I don't know how he does that. I don't know, he sprays his face and then he puts goggles on and they don't get this orange color, orange tint. And also the hands. It's very funny. You see this great guy with tiny hands.
It is pretty remarkable. There's a lot to pick up on. You've got one cartoon that kind of reappears where Donald Trump is like his face is a trampoline and you refer to him as the trampoline. Explain that.
Yeah, the trampoline. When he was elected, all the people, all the right wing, the government, they were jumping up and down from happiness on the trampoline because they say, oh, here comes the Messiah, somebody who gets us, somebody who understands, the settlements and everything. We can get away with anything now. But then the trampoline started to tear from the bottom and people fell through because they realized it's not such a great deal for the right wing after all. They don't really understand it, but he suddenly gets along very well with Mahmoud Abbas. He suddenly, John Spicer forgets the Holocaust centers.
Yeah,
suddenly everything falls apart, and they are very shocked. So that trampoline is torn now and people are falling on their asses. And, it's very funny, but it's not a pretty sight.
So President Trump arrives in Israel on Monday, and I read one headline on an Israeli news site that said, official Trump itinerary confirmed, Western Wall, yes, Masada, no, Masada being that historic site and temple. I thought it was a joke, but it's actually serious, right?
You know, the Western Wall. He wanted to come to the Western Wall, and he wanted to coordinate it with Israeli authorities. And then somebody at the American embassy, they said, hey, what are you talking about? The Western Wall is the Palestinian territory. It was a big deal here. Everybody was up in arms because of that. He didn't want anybody to come with him to the Western Wall. He goes alone to the Western Wall with no authorities. So I did the cartoon I'm doing this Sunday, is that he's taking one of Israel's supermodels. We have this famous supermodel. That's the Israeli authority that he takes with him to the Western Wall, supermodel.
There's so much stuff going on in Washington, as you know, right now, as Trump takes off on this visit, and not to mention, the sensitive intelligence provided by Israel that he kind of forked over to the Russians. Is there going to be much of a welcome, Matt?
I don't know. I don't think that everybody's very excited about this, the leak. I think we have much bigger problems. I mean, the leak is something very specific. From your perspective, I understand that this leak is very important, but here it's just just another funny Trump joke.
What do you think about Donald Trump's tweets?
First of all, it's great for cartoons because you get to use this bird. The bird is great. I mean, that's they will be his legacy. The first president in history that will be remembered by his tweets. It's the first time we get this close contact to the president. We really see him. And unfortunately, not such a pretty sight. 70-year-old guy in a bathrobe in the White House, so tweeting in the middle of the night. That will be remembered from him if anybody is left after the apocalypse.
Uri Fink, Israeli cartoonist and satirist, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Check out our selection of Uri Fink's Trump cartoons at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Okay, if I told you that there is a multi-billion-dollar industry that thrives in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., in the ports of Sicily, and in the jungles of Uganda, you might find the answer a little challenging. The industry is sex trafficking, but in the 21st century, in the places I mentioned, it's probably more accurate to call it sexual slavery. We're talking millions of women and girls, some held captive by gangs and forced to pay back their debts, others tricked into the work by promises of a better life. But most of the women don't stay in this bondage forever. They do get out. And that's the focus of a new series from our Across Women's Lives team, Those Who Get Out and What Happens After. Christina Asquith heads up our Across Women's Lives project. So, Christina, the theme is the journey out. It can't be an easy journey to get out of this life, is it?
Definitely not, Marco. The journey out is always difficult, but we decided to focus on it because when you look at the women and girls who are trafficked, the majority of them do get out eventually. In fact, one woman from New Jersey, and a Mexican-American woman that we spoke with, she's 84 now. She's breaking her silence about how she was trafficked when she was 14. She's never told her story before, but no one helped her out. There were no services. There was no one rescuing her. And that's the case with a lot of the women who are trafficked that we talk to. They get themselves out of a trafficking situation, often overcoming huge amount of shame, often rebelling against a family maybe who sold them into trafficking. Mm-hmm. So it's that internal resilience and it's that path out that we see these women taking by the reins and owning that we really wanted to highlight in our series.
And why tell kind of the circumstances at the back end of these people's lives as opposed to kind of the forces that got them into this in the first place?
So trafficking and the what we call the fallen angel narrative of a woman who goes from schoolgirl to the street, it's such an overwrought and such a cliched story that we've seen in the media so many times before. And we didn't want to tell that story because, like I said, when you go out and you talk to women and girls, you see a different story that is so inspired by their own resilience in getting themselves out of this situation. And, of course, when we think about how do we want to begin to tackle something as massive as trafficking, well, it comes down to understanding the challenges that women and girls face and getting themselves out of it and really understanding it at a very intimate level. And you can only get that when you talk to these women and girls themselves.
One of the reports comes from Sicily. Why is that an important place to talk about in terms of sex trafficking?
Sicily is a major port for migrants coming from the Middle East and Africa into Europe. And we've seen a big uptick in Nigerian women in particular. This last year, their numbers doubled to 11,000. And these women, you know, our reporter tells us they stumble off these ships. They're hungry. They're often coming off alongside caskets of victims who have died on the way over. They're put in a corner in the port under a sign that literally says the vulnerables. And they have in their hands a phone number of a madam that a trafficker back in Nigeria has given them. And it's like they have this choice. Do they stay in this detention center where it's overcrowded, it's sweaty, there's no future opportunity, or do they call this trafficker? And so they call a trafficker, they get out, but it's a, you know, now they're trafficked and they're told that they owe 30,000 euro for being trafficked over the cost, that there is a pathway out for them if they can pay this back. And, you know, the next thing they know, they're kind of on a highway alongside a gas station and this is their life.
A different sort of trap.
That's right. And so our reporter there talked to three or four different women who had gone through this journey, who had gotten out of it, and really walks us through that journey getting out.
What an intense story. That story, by the way, is already up at PRI.org. So the first daughter, Ivanka Trump, tweeted this week about her second White House meeting on trafficking. How big an issue is this really for her, and what is she doing about it?
Yeah, so Ivanka has met twice now within the White House on anti-trafficking initiatives, and people are cautious about embracing what she's doing. We're kind of waiting to see. She has not announced any specific plans yet. She has said that she wants to hear about what the problem is. She wants to see what the administration can do about it. I think it's worth noting that anti-trafficking and anti-slavery initiatives are popular among her father's base.
That's Christina Asquith, who heads up our Across Women's Lives project. Christina, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
We start off this series of stories today in Brazil. The economic boom of the past decade there has brought sex trafficking, but more generally, labor trafficking to cities across the country and to mega events like the 2016 Rio Olympics. Catherine Osborne has this story about the women fighting trafficking in Brazil.
Soy de la ciudad de La Paz.
Carmen Lopez was living in La Paz, Bolivia, when a friend's brother told her she could make good money working in a clothing factory in Sao Paulo.
Yo quería salir de allá.
Lopez says she wanted a change, so she packed up and traveled with her 8-year-old son to the border. Bolivians can work legally in Brazil because of South America's trade agreement. But the language barrier, from Spanish to Portuguese, made it hard for her to find information about her future employer.
Él me dijo que aún falta pagar el pasaje. Yo después de 4 meses...
Lopez, who asked that I not use her real name, says her boss in Brazil bought her the bus ticket from Bolivia to come to her new job. But when she arrived, she found out the truth. She was made to work for months without pay in a cramped workshop. Her employer warned her that if she left for another job, it would be even worse than this, where she wasn't given enough food to feed her son.
Ellos querían que ayude en la cocina.
She says she finally got the courage to escape when her boss tried to make her son work too in the kitchen. Experts on labor trafficking in Brazil worry that Lopez's story is becoming more common.
Labor protections are totally at risk in Brazil.
Fabiana Severa is a public defender. She points out Brazil's new president is pushing for big changes this year in labor regulations. One bill would do away with surprise inspections. And already a new law allows companies to outsource without being responsible for labor abuses down their supply chains.
Abuses usually happen with people that are more invisible.
It's that invisibility that Lopez fights today. Trained by an NGO, she educates other migrants on how to avoid being exploited.
Tenemos derechos.
We have rights, she tells them. If you're not getting fair payment and rest time, you can leave your job. You can access some public services and take courses to learn another skill.
Yo les digo que no pidan que vengan las personas de allá.
And she says, you shouldn't encourage others to take the same unfair job you had. This kind of organizing, which is based in communities of workers themselves, reaches places that labor inspectors can't. Some call it whisper organizing, because the way you can quietly tell another worker, you don't have to do this. Today, Lopez owns her own sewing shop in Sao Paulo. Piles of pamphlets about trafficking and forced labor cover her front counter. Neighbors drop by for advice. Lopez gives a lot of guidance about something she's often seen as connected with trafficking, domestic violence. It's a push factor, like poverty, that leads people to move even when a new job seems risky. And Lopez knows, because that's what put her on the road to Brazil 6 years ago.
Que no permitan que les haga así pequeña.
She tells women not to let other people make them feel small and to reach out to their networks for help. At a recent training session at the NGO in Sao Paulo, volunteers like Lopez introduce themselves by picking a word that describes them.
Solidaridad.
The word she chooses is solidarity.
Solidaridad.
For The World, I'm Catherine Osborne, Sao Paulo, Brazil.
We have more from our investigation into sex trafficking on our website. Just head to pri.org/sold. I'm Marco Werman. One Filipina story of virtual slavery while working as a family's live-in servant sparks a huge debate among Filipino Americans.
I think a lot in the Filipino community were thinking Lola Eudocia's story is not the only one, that this is a pervasive problem.
That story is just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Rupa Shenoy joins me. Hey, Rupa.
Hi, Marco.
I'm halfway through this incredible article, My Family Slave. It's the cover story in The Atlantic this month. I know you've read it. Have you read the whole thing?
I have.
It clearly foreshadows the tragic life of this woman, Lola. Who is she?
Lola means grandmother. She's from the Philippines, and she was brought by the author's family to this country.
And the family's also from the Philippines,
correct,
right?
Yeah. To be a servant, a live-in servant.
So Lola is dead. Alex Tison, the reporter who wrote the story, is dead. But there's still something to talk about here, and that is the incredible reaction to this article. And it's just been shared everywhere on social media.
Yeah, it's clearly a flashpoint for Filipinos, Filipino Americans. The reaction has been very diverse. People love it, people hate it, and there are in-betweens. There's a Western perspective to it, there's a Filipino perspective to it, there's an American-Filipino perspective to it. So the reporter I spoke with kind of went through and cataloged all these responses just, you know, to document this moment of reaction to this very striking issue in the Filipino-American community and the Filipino community. Her name is Marnette Federis. She's a Filipino-American reporter in California.
All right, let's hear your conversation with her.
Would you mind breaking it down for us, the specific arguments for and against what people are saying?
The story came out, and it was very emotional. Everybody had all sorts of emotional responses to it. Initially, a lot of people, you know, kind of praised Tison for his piece and called it beautiful writing. And then there was a backlash. People were like, no, this is not beautiful writing, or at least this is not a beautiful story. This is about abuse. This is about slavery, and we should all be angry about this. And then I think after that, at least from the Filipino community, was a feeling of defensiveness, sort of like, okay, yes, the anger is totally legitimate. However, we need to take a time out. There's a lot of other cultural forces or historical context that needs to be considered when it comes to reading this story. You know, everybody's angry. However, I think a lot in the Filipino community were thinking, they know Lola Eudocia's story is not the only one, that this is a pervasive problem. And so if you just look at it in the lens of anger, it doesn't actually solve the full problem. And so now I'm kind of seeing a lot more reflection, a lot more of how does this even happen? Why does this even happen? And sort of, okay, what's the next step? What can we do to learn from this?
Can you give us more context around the culture? People like Lola, the role that they've played in Filipino culture.
So I'm not a historian. What I know is sort of just from my own education and my own observation. But, you know, the Philippines is a country that has a really long history of colonialism, hundreds of years under the Spanish rule and then the United States. And so that kind of colonial history created a really powerful dynamic between groups of people, between the wealthy and the poor, between the powerful and the weak. There's very, very few powerful and very, very rich people at the top and a lot of people at the very bottom who are in poverty. And, you know, sort of that history has created very distinct classes within the culture. And in the Philippines, it's actually very common for people to have domestic workers at their homes. You don't have to be super rich. This means nannies, housekeepers, you know, people who do your laundry. Even people in the working and middle class, they're able to have domestic workers. It's part of the landscape and it's kind of part of the economy. And some people are in such poverty and, you know, they don't have access to education. And so a lot of people are willing to take on that domestic work. And sometimes it's the only option and it's a matter of survival. So when it's in that kind of situation, some of the employers feel like they're actually doing the domestic worker a favor, that paying their worker, you know, maybe a really small wage or maybe paying them room and board is enough. And the domestic workers might feel, you know, there's a little bit of internalization about that. They might feel indebted to the employer because, you know, what's the other option? And that kind of power dynamic, it creates a situation that's really rife for abuse. So I think what people in the Filipino community want others to know is that there are all these other things at play when it comes to the story of Lola Eudocia. And beyond being angry and calling for imprisonment for the Tison family, you have to ask yourself, how did this even come to be?
Yeah, and it really depends on point of view, right? Have you thought about that, how these lenses are coming into play? Like, there's one way that a family from the West would see this. Another way, as someone like Tison would see it, as a person who grew up in the States. And he describes in the story kind of watching old movies and seeing the way African-Americans were treated as slaves and slowly matching that up with the way he saw his Lola being treated. Have you thought about that aspect?
Americans are looking at this from the American lens. Filipinos are looking at this from the Filipino lens. And, you know, that's why there's kind of a certain tone of defensiveness. Tison, you know, it's interesting because he was born in the Philippines and he saw this going on and he saw the dynamics there from the very beginning. And then he goes to the United States and, yeah, you're supposed to know about civil rights and, you know, he learned about the history of African-American slavery, and that's kind of where he starts to see, you know, Lola's situation for what it really was. But, and, you know, so his lens is Filipino-American lens, and that's a very different type of perspective as well. And the way that people are responding, it really does correspond with their perspectives and who they are.
Do you think a kid who grew up in the States has a right to judge a culture where they didn't grow up?
You know, no culture is perfect, right? And I've seen Filipino writers talk about this, or Filipino, you know, netizens who are saying, you know, it's okay for people to criticize certain aspects of society. What we do with that criticism is really important. You know, we need to talk about things that we see going on that doesn't feel right, you know? And a lot of people are open to criticisms, but I think it has to be more than just being angry at certain things or being, you know, kind of reactionary. There needs to be a lot of reflection there.
Thank you very much, Marnette. I really appreciate your time.
Sure, no problem.
Marnette Federicere speaking with the world's Roopa Shenoy about reaction to a pretty dramatic story in The Atlantic this month titled My Family Slave. It's a kind of story you'd hear in Roopa's podcast, Otherhood. You can subscribe to Otherhood on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Voters in Iran are eagerly awaiting the results of today's presidential election there. Many outside the country are paying close attention, too. The stakes are high. The race between moderate incumbent Hassan Rouhani and hardline cleric Ibrahim Raisi could determine the future of the country's relationship with the West, not to mention the fate of the Iran nuclear deal, which has been criticized by Raisi. What might happen to the accord if Rouhani is not reelected? That's what we asked Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council.
You know, it will be a difficult situation because we'll have in the United States a president who has criticized the agreement heavily, and you'd have in Iran a president who has criticized the agreement heavily. So the chances of it surviving, I think, would go down. The chances for some miscalculation would definitely increase. If Rouhani is reelected, you know, we can be a little bit more confident, I think, that Iran will continue to abide by the agreement.
So what are the top-of-mind issues for Iranian voters? What are you hearing from your sources in Iran, Barbara?
Well, I think the economy is clearly always at the forefront of everyone's mind. There's a lot of disappointment that the nuclear deal did not deliver widespread prosperity to Iranians, at least not very quickly. But I think they're also thinking about Iran's image in the world. They're thinking about the lack of stability in the region. For that reason, I've always thought that the incumbent president, Hassan Rouhani, has a bit of an edge. He's steady hands. He's very well known. He has a lot of diplomatic contacts. And with so much instability in the region and so much uncertainty in Washington, I would think Iranians would want to stick with him.
I mean, given how much sanctions have hurt the Iranian economy, where do the candidates stand on issues that they don't really have much control over?
Rouhani has come out very strong against some of the activities of hardline elements that he says have hurt the Iranian economy. You know, he's a man of the regime, but he's tried to criticize the Revolutionary Guard and some of the intelligence operatives who have given Iran a bad name in the world. Raisi, his opponent, has stuck mostly to economic issues. He's promising to increase cash payments to the poor. He talks about the resistance economy, that Iran can somehow be more self-reliant. It's an argument that worked for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad some years ago, but people have seen that movie before. Mm. So I'm not sure that Raisi will be able to pull it off.
And you think Rouhani has the edge here?
Raisi people are already charging fraud, which means that they think they're losing. But, you know, it could be rigged. It was rigged in 2009. And the actual results when they're announced, you know, we may not have complete faith that they are what they are. But I think the likeliest outcome is that Rouhani wins and they give Raisi some extra votes. So he doesn't look like he's lost by too much. And he's still a contender to succeed the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, passes from the scene, which is, of course, the really important choice that
right.
Iran faces.
Is there a scenario where the results of this election could just reshape Iran's relationship with the U.S.?
No, in a word.
Why not?
Rouhani is very cautious. He has talked, and he talked in the campaign, about trying to get rid of the remaining sanctions against Iran. That would require a massive negotiation with the United States, which has all of these sanctions, financial sanctions, others that are linked to Iranian human rights practices, to missile launches, to Iran's support for Hezbollah and Hamas. You know, so I don't know whether the supreme leader of Iran would give permission to Rouhani and his team to actually open a negotiation like that. And the last word on these kinds of decisions remains with the supreme leader. That's why whoever wins today, the commander-in-chief, the true power remains the supreme leader.
So finally, Barbara, Ahmadinejad was hoping to run in this election, but the clerics barred him from running again last month. What does that suggest about this man who once had a lot of power? And what does it tell us about how Iran is evolving under the clerics?
Well, it suggests that having been president is no guarantee of future happiness in Iran. It's a tough environment, but I like to talk about the Iranian people, and they're the ones who have evolved. They have a vibrant society. They're very secular, very creative, very well educated, very sophisticated. And they put up with a system that gives them only a small amount of choice. And they vote, frankly, in a way that is much more mature than many elsewhere in the world, perhaps even in our own country.
Barbara Slavin with the Atlantic Council. Good to speak with you again.
Thanks, Marco. Always a pleasure.
Back now to President Donald Trump's first trip overseas. It includes stops in Saudi Arabia, Israel, Vatican City, Belgium, and Italy. The 9-day journey will likely involve more than a few state dinners, banquets, and working lunches. But Trump is a notoriously picky eater, so we wondered, how's he going to manage all these exotic new tastes and textures? Tom Sitsema is the food critic for The Washington Post. All right, so the first stop, Saudi Arabia, shouldn't be too challenging because they're accommodating Trump with steak. Well done.
They are.
With the side of ketchup. Do you know what the protocol setup was behind getting to that menu?
Well, you know, anytime with protocol, it's so sensitive. It's a bit of a state secret, the people who work in protocol, because they have to know the sleeping habits, the eating habits, all the personal likes and dislikes of visiting heads of state. And in this case, they got the word that this is a guy who likes steak. You know, he's not a very adventurous eater. He hoovers his food. He's not, say, those who have eaten with him, you know. He's not someone who really enjoys the pleasures of the table. He likes to sit down, eat, and be done in under an hour.
So Saudi, Israel, Belgium for a dinner with the new French president Macron and a dinner with Italy's leader. He likes pasta, so he should be good to go with his Italian counterpart. But
where
do you anticipate problems?
You know, I think he's a bit of a clean freak. He likes clean environments. He likes to know where his food is coming from. Food safety is a big priority for him. In fact, he ate a lot of fast food on the campaign trail because, you know, cleanliness was something that was associated with fast food chains, he thought. You know, one bad hamburger and you can destroy McDonald's, he said.
Yeah, I mean, he's essentially a germaphobe. And here he is basically admitting that to John Harwood on CNBC.
I'm imagining that you skip the dip appetizers because, like Seinfeld, you've got a double dip issue.
I was out recently and somebody was dipping the shrimp into sauce. This guy weighed like 370 pounds and he had a shrimp and he dipped it into the sauce. Then he dipped it a second time. I never even met the guy. I said, you just double dipped. It was incredible. He didn't know what I meant and then he understood it. I mean, he was a nice guy, but like I didn't have any shrimp.
He was straight out of Seinfeld.
No, he went right into it. He did it a double. I've seen that happen many times. It's pretty disgusting, right?
Right.
It's like putting your whole mouth in the bowl.
Oh, my goodness. That is so him.
So, as you say, he hoovers up his food, a fast eater. Some of these official dinners can go on for hours, though. And with his French and Italian counterparts, I mean, it's all about slow eating. What's your advice for him? Chew every bite in like 20 times?
Wow. Chew every bite. Engage in people. Pause. Put down your fork. Those are all habits that we should all, you know, be involved in, I think. But again, he's someone who really likes to eat fast and he just needs to, for the sake of diplomacy, world peace and everything else, I would advise him to chew slowly and listen.
Tom Sitsema, the food critic for The Washington Post, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
President Donald Trump isn't the only headliner in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia this weekend. Country music star Toby Keith will be playing a free concert, but in keeping with Saudi rules, only men will be allowed to attend the show. It wasn't Toby Keith who caught our attention, though. It's the Saudi pop star who will be appearing with Keith. His name is Rabe Saker. For more than 30 years, he's been building a successful career inside the kingdom with songs like this, a tune called Yum Wahed. صار عندي كل واحد كل ما حولي تشابه كل واحد مثل الواحد. Rabe seemed to assure his place among the elite in Saudi with a special song he wrote in the 1980s for the dedication of the elaborate King Fahd Causeway that connects Saudi Arabia with Bahrain. Imagine how a song like that will square with Toby Keith's usual fare. Will the Saudis be serenaded with beer for my horses or courtesy of the red, white, and blue? I'm guessing they'll definitely be ready for Rabe Saker to take the stage. Okay, exhausted by the onslaught of news? I'll bet you're ready to slow down. Unplug. Here's a thought. Listen more closely to the sounds of nature that tend to fade into the background. That's exactly what biologist David George Haskell did while researching his new book, The Songs of Trees. So after a nutty week and heading into the weekend, don't you want to hear a bit of what he heard when he started listening to trees? The World's Carolyn Beeler talked to and listened with Haskell.
I asked David George Haskell how he started listening to trees, because really? His answer, like nearly everything he says, was completely earnest.
Birds were my gateway drug. I first started identifying them by ear.
A very good ear, it turns out.
And then from that, I realized that trees all had their own voices, and there were lots and lots of stories behind those sounds. And so sound is the great revealing sense.
Haskell was born in the UK and raised in Paris, where he remembers listening to birds as a kid. Now he teaches writing at the University of the South in Tennessee. But he traveled around the world to research his new book, The Songs of Trees. He spent 2 years listening to and recording a dozen specific trees and their surroundings. This is the sound of rain splattering on a giant ceibo tree and the plants growing underneath it in the Ecuadorian Amazon.
And each plant has its own sound that relates to the shape and the size of the leaf. How thick is it? So here we're hearing the big raindrops falling from high in the canopy. And we're listening to different species. This one, I think, is Inga, which is medium-sized tapered leaf. Then this deeper one is the leaf of an avocado plant. And in the background, we hear the leaf litter. The leaf litter has a little fizzle and pop.
These plants growing on the ground below live on the rain that drips off the ceibo's tapered leaves above. Haskell also turned his ears to the animals that live among these plants.
A low-frequency sound are the sounds of monkeys waking up, the howl of monkeys, see the dawn coming, and they climb to the top of the trees and release this sound.
Indigenous people also use ceibo trees to communicate.
People living in the forest, the Guarani, when they become lost in the forest, they find a ceibo tree, and they hammer on it with sticks or their arms, and the whole tree vibrates like a big subwoofer, sending out a signal, I'm lost. Come and help me find my way.
Haskell's book focuses on these connections between plants and animals and people, from the jungles of South America to the streets of Manhattan. But it's not all kumbaya tree hugger stuff. Haskell also describes how these relationships in nature lead inevitably to death. This is an underwater recording of a sable palm. That's a tree that's evolved to live right on the edge of the ocean.
So this is a very small wave reaching into the roots of a sable palm, and the hydrophone reveals quite a lot of energy punching into the roots and washing sand grains away.
After Haskell recorded this on an island off the coast of Georgia, that wave energy knocked the tree over and killed it. Haskell says the stories of nature are easy to hear if you just learn how to listen.
The main practice is to pour one's attention into the ears.
We're up on a hill in Boston in a stand of Eastern and Japanese white pines. Haskell takes off his rain jacket so it doesn't rustle, and he takes an acoustic inventory.
We're hearing sirens, hearing a diesel engine.
I mostly hear those traffic noises, but Haskell, he hears a lot more.
I'm hearing blue jays and a flicker.
For Haskell, every sound triggers a story. They start small, but then they grow into mini science lessons.
Some robins that are newly arrived from the south.
Probably, like they have for millennia, he says, with seeds in their bellies.
So this is one way in which the north got colonized after the last ice age. All of this region was covered in ice. Every single plant growing here came from somewhere else.
Sometimes, like now, the stories Haskell hears are about how trees got to where they are. Other times, they're about the work they do once they get there. We walk by an oak.
This is a very old northern red oak.
And he tells me how rain would sound as it trickles down the tree's twisted bark. The sound of how trees help prevent flooding in heavy rainfall. From all the sounds he's listened to over the years, Haskell says he's learned one big lesson.
Human lives and tree lives are intimately intertwined.
Both while trees are alive and after we've chopped them down to make into paper or lumber.
Everything from every breath of air that we take, every time we read a book or step into a building, through to trees' roles in the ecology that keeps the world as we know it functioning. Human lives and tree lives are deeply connected.
So next time you're outside, why not take off your headphones and give listening, really actually listening, a try? We could all do with feeling just a bit more connected. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Boston.
Those raindrops were seriously soothing. Just a little public service mindfulness for these chaotic times. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.